Unbound. This is Unbound, the podcast that tries to nudge the boundaries of philosophy. And this is Kay.
And Giuseppe.
And with you and a bunch of other friends at the new school, we are going to push the boundaries of philosophy. Are you ready? Let's begin our journey to become unbound. Hi, I'm Kay Eskins, and I'm a philosophy student doing an MA at the New School, and this is Unbound, the podcast that tries to redefine the boundaries of philosophy. In every episode, we invite a guest to discuss philosophy with us. But before introducing our guest, let me introduce our other host for today.
My name is Giuseppe Vicinanza, and I'm also a master's student in philosophy at the New School for Social Research. We are very excited to have Tamsin Kimoto join us today for Unbound. Tamsin Kimoto attained a BA in philosophy at Northern Arizona University and then an MA in philosophy at Loyola University, and now they are a PhD student in philosophy with a certificate in women's gender and sexuality studies at Emory University, where they have also been teaching since 2018. Their research centers around trans studies and women of color feminisms, especially questions in critical phenomenology, political philosophy, and the metaphysics of gender. But they also have an interest in bioethics and philosophy of race. The last work by Tamsin is a book review of Gay Salomon's The Life and Death of Letitia King, A Critical Phenomenology of Transphobia, which appeared in 2020 on GLQ, a Journal of Lesbian and Gay Studies. So Tamsin, this is the dry and formal introduction. Now we would like to ask you, how would you introduce yourself, maybe in a more personal way?
Yeah, I mean, so just a small correction. So I'm actually currently a visiting assistant professor in philosophy and women, gender, and sexuality studies at Goucher College in Baltimore. And yeah, I think more personally, I am just someone who enjoys talking and thinking about politics and actually doing political work. Yeah, I'm never sure what to say with these kinds of things.
I was going to just go ahead and ask if you could tell us a little bit personally, like from your perspective about your journey to this point academically and what you experienced in terms of your identity and how that might have had conflict with the philosophical discipline, but also how that drove what you were passionate about studying.
Yeah, that's a big question. So part of it for me, so how I came into philosophy was my first year of college, I just sort of on a whim took a class in ancient philosophy, just thinking that it would just fulfill some kind of requirement for me and that I would be able to move on and do other things. Mm-hmm. And I ended up sort of falling in love with the class and with the kinds of questions that I was able to ask and the kinds of topics we were able to explore. And then from there, I sort of jumped immediately into a class on philosophy of race, which was, for me, an incredibly formative experience. Taking a class in the philosophy of race in my first year of undergrad as a young person of color, seeing that the kinds of questions that were occurring to me were philosophical, that they were exactly the kinds of things that philosophers should be thinking and talking about. So for me, questions of race, questions of identity have always been sort of central to what it means to be doing philosophical work. It's the kind of stuff that pulls me in, that excites me, and that I always want to know more about. Mm-hmm. And that's been a sort of consistent theme of my studies throughout undergrad and into graduate school, and even now as I'm entering a faculty position, questions of race, gender, sexuality continue to be sort of central for me. And I have been fortunate to find a large community of people who support that kind of work. But obviously, as we all know about philosophy, it isn't always easy to do that kind of work, especially if you're also a person of color, if you're also not a man. Mm-hmm. And all of these other backgrounds.
So you have support from other students and also institutionally, at least at Northern Arizona?
As an undergrad, I was really lucky. The two of my faculty in the department were incredibly supportive, the first two that I had. So the woman who taught my philosophy of race class, Elaine Brown, is an Alaska Native woman and was at the time completing a PhD in philosophy at McGill. And it was really sort of, she's been a huge support. We still keep in contact and talk on and off. And just having her there from the get-go, someone whose experiences were different but similar enough to my own as someone who's mixed race, as someone who's a person of color in philosophy, it was really hugely impactful.
One thing that I was curious about is, so we've interviewed a few people before you, and I think all of them had other subjects that they studied as well in their maybe undergrad, maybe someone did psychology or history. Correct me if I'm wrong, you did an undergrad in philosophy, then a master's in philosophy. Now you are a PhD student and a professor in philosophy. What do you think has led you to stick with philosophy so faithfully? What do you think in this subject gives you better tools, I guess, to do the kind of research that you want to do?
It's funny to be described as someone who's sticking faithfully to philosophy, because I always think of myself as having one foot out the door. I mean, even as an undergrad, I ended up getting my major in philosophy, but I must have changed my major like at least a dozen times over the 4 years. I tried to be an English major. I was political science. I was ethnic studies. I jumped around a lot, and it was really by my junior year that I sort of realized, well, I'm almost done with a philosophy degree, so I may as well just finish that. So it was sort of an accident. And then going into my master's program, I was more or less committed to doing philosophy because I knew that I wanted to study race and gender and sexuality, and it seemed the field that allowed me to ask the questions in the way I wanted to ask them. But my master's program was incredibly conservative in terms of what counted as philosophy. It was very wed to ideas of the canon and ideas of what kinds of questions are proper for philosophers to be engaged in.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like the new school, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, it was the kind of Loyola Marymount at the time I was there. I don't know what it's like now. It was the kind of program where the general sort of attitude was that philosophy was sort of done after Heidegger. Maybe a couple people sneak through and are asking important questions, but it was sort of radical to a lot of my faculty and colleagues that, like, the philosophers that I latched on to most were people like Michel Foucault and Judith Butler, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, I was told explicitly by a faculty member there that feminist philosophy isn't actually philosophy.
Heard the same.
So, yeah. So it wasn't the most nurturing environment, and I almost quit. What kept me in it was a professor there who's actually in the political science department, Andrew Diltz, really encouraged me in developing my own thinking in the way that was sort of he didn't try to make me into the kind of scholar that I'm not. He really understood, like, where I was and where I wanted to go, and helped me build in that kind of a direction. And that was sort of my second year of the program, so it was application time, and I just ended up applying. And I got into a PhD program at the University of Memphis, which I was told by my colleagues made sense because the philosophy program there isn't really a philosophy program, but it's a political theory program. Mm. So it made sense that I would get in there. I was there for 2 years, and I eventually left, and I actually went to Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies program here at Emory before I ended up back in philosophy. So I know looking at my CV, it looks like I've been very faithful to philosophy, but it's pulling me back in.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, maybe this is really pointed, but it seems like from what you're saying that you did experience a lot of challenges in terms of studying what you wanted to study in philosophy, and that even from some of the comments that you're saying that Judith Butler or Michel Foucault would be not, you know, as highlighted. Did you experience, were there ever times that on your syllabi trans people were represented? Did you feel like you experienced like direct transphobia? Like sometimes at the new school, people don't even remember pronouns. So I'm just curious if that's something that you experienced, or did you feel like there were resources at Emory in terms of the faculty and other students?
Yeah, so that's going to be a long answer again, in part because I didn't start transitioning until about 4 years ago. So that was already at that point 4 years into graduate studies. So at that point, I'd already completed my master's program and started and stopped a PhD at the University of Memphis. I would say that I mean, for me, it's difficult. This is a question I get asked a lot. And for me, it's difficult to sort of disarticulate which experiences are transphobia, which are racism, which are classism, any of these kinds of things. Like, I often tell people that I was very prepared for dealing with transphobia in philosophy just because I had so much experience dealing with racism in philosophy.
Right.
And then I also think about it in part two, right? While there have been trans people working in philosophy for years, Jacob Hale and Talia Betcher in particular, trans philosophy didn't sort of start taking off until the last 4 or 5 years, really. And after that point, I would see occasionally a trans thinker on syllabi. And certainly at Emory, I was very lucky to have faculty members who were supportive of the kinds of questions I wanted to ask and never sort of shied away from me bringing in trans philosophical or trans studies content. But yeah, I mean, it is amazing to me still that I am in philosophy after all of the stuff that I've had to put up with.
Yeah, definitely. Is there some way that, I guess, I mean, I know this is like, you could write a whole book on this, but how would you define philosophy in terms of, you said that from the very beginning, the kinds of questions about race and gender have always been central. So is there just some way that you would define philosophy, I guess, at least in your practice?
That is such a hard question. I don't know that I have a good definition for philosophy. I mean, I can tell you what pulled me back into philosophy was the way that philosophers ask questions and the way that we're trained to pursue answers. So I think there's a kind of almost relentlessness in the way that philosophers are when there's a question on the table. And I think we're able to get deeper into topics in philosophy than I found I was able to in other fields. I mean, when I was in the WGSS program, some of my colleagues would sometimes in exasperation say that I was such a philosopher because I would ask them what they meant by terms. I would ask them to define their terms and I would probe how they were using them and whether or not they were consistent in their usage. So I don't know that there's a good definition of philosophy or that I use one as I'm doing my work, but I think about it in terms of just the pursuit of questioning and a kind of slowness of thinking. I think in philosophy, we're trained to think for a very long time about things. I think that's not always a good thing. But I do think that it leads to sometimes more careful articulations of concepts.
I think that's a great definition right there of philosophy, actually.
So speaking of articulations of concepts, Tamsin, I found your work extremely interesting. And the reason why is exactly going back to concepts that you kind of did some work to come up with your own concepts. There was so much going on in the stuff that I read from you. So I think everyone should go and check out your stuff because it's just very good philosophy, I think. One question that I had, you wrote this chapter for a book called Asian American Feminism and Women of Color Politics, and your chapter is called Becoming Restive. So when discussing the notion of orientation in the paper, you refer to Sarah Mad's claim that whiteness is what is here, a line from which the word unfolds. And then you go on to describe how non-white people can be made to feel out of place, for instance, in the common experience of having to account where they are really from, right? And then what I found very interesting was that you complete Ahmed's account by saying that whiteness is also there. You say that towards which we are oriented. So the measure of success towards which non-white people are expected to strive towards, which on a side note made me think in a wider context, beyond philosophy and beyond the US, of the indicators of development that supposedly global institutions use to evaluate the state of a country and how these indicators consider developed that which white people have strived toward and underdeveloped that which is not like that. But going back to a more individual level of discussion, I wanted to ask you, how does whiteness as a there influence the life of someone who isn't white? If you're comfortable with sharing your experience, how has it affected your life? What's that experience like in the day-to-day?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question. We can take philosophy as an example. I think keeping in mind the goals of the podcast. I mean, as we know, philosophy is an incredibly white discipline. Casual glance around will tell you that. I mean, I don't know what the demographics are at the new school. They didn't look super promising in terms of racial diversity. But part of what I mean by whiteness as a there, right, as the line for success, is just in terms of the everyday comportment of people in spaces like philosophy classrooms, like philosophy conferences, and how certain bodies, certain people are policed, how certain background experiences are sort of assumed, right? So, like, I think, for example, of the experience of the gaze that Sartre describes in Being and Nothingness. And I remember when I read that as an undergrad, and all of these white people in the classroom had this experience being like, wow, it's so true. When someone else looks at you, like, you can't really control how they're seeing you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Your whole world swirls the drain, or however he puts it. But for me, that's just the condition of walking down the street. And it always has been, encountering the gaze of another and having that recognition, right? It wasn't to me this huge revelation that I'm not master of the world. And I think in part that's one of the theirs that I'm talking about, right? The sort of stereotypical attitude of the philosopher is someone who's incredibly self-assured, who's arrogant almost to a certain point, right? And I have never been that. It's never been how I've understood myself in the world. It's never been how the world has understood me. But it is the measure of success, in a certain sense, the kind of attitude that I'm told that I should come to embody, or should have come to embody, I guess, in the process of finishing a PhD. But it doesn't register for me. And yet it is a standard, right? And you can think about this too. There's been a lot of conversations right now on social media about what professionalism looks like and what we mean when we talk about professionalism and all of the ways in which that term gets used to police the bodies and actions of people of color, of women, and poor people moving in the academy. So when we're talking about whiteness as there, I think we also should recognize, right, the imbrications of capital in that, right, of heteropatriarchy, that all of these things come together, right? The there is something like what Audre Lorde calls the mythical norm, which in philosophy happens to look like a great deal of the profession.
Do you feel in particular, when you talked also in this paper about the model minority myth, and do you feel like that in particular has operated in your studies or in your life in relation to whiteness, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, the model minority myth is so tricky to talk about, I think, in my experience, in part because I am mixed race. And so the way that my race gets read is oftentimes it's ambiguous. Mm. So a lot of people, when they encounter me, don't really know exactly what I am in a lot of different ways. That's a question that I get asked a lot. I think in part you can see the myth of the model minority sort of in terms of the distribution of where you find Asian people in philosophy, right? Emily Lee talked about this in an interview she did with George Yancey, I think, that one doesn't often find Asian philosophers working in directly political sort of topics, and some of that has to do with the experience of being told one is out of place, one isn't acting in quite the right way, when you ask sharp questions, probing questions, when you're loud, when you take up space, because these are all of the kinds of things that the model minority myth discourages us from engaging in, right? Yeah, and I think it's also, right, the demographics for what racial diversity looks like in the discipline do suggest that there's some greater representation of Asian people in philosophy. And some of that, I think, has to do with our access to, for some of us anyway, our access to higher education or even seeing postgraduate education as attainable. For my family, it was never really a question of whether or not I would pursue further education beyond a bachelor's degree, but I think for a lot of people it is. For a lot of people of color in particular, it is a question of whether or not one can or should.
Did you feel as though there were Asian philosophers represented on your syllabi? Did you learn? I mean, at least the it seems to me that the myth of philosophy as a general discipline is that philosophy started in Greece at a very particular time, which seems to be, of course, we know is not the case. And in fact, philosophy probably started either in Asia or Africa, but we don't really study those texts as the founding texts or anything. So have you had experience where that has been the case, or in general, is there not really much of a study of? I know even saying Asian philosophy is already kind of grouping a bunch of different philosophy together, but.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I had an actual class in, and it, for me, it was Chinese philosophy until the second year of my master's program. There's a scholar at Loyola Marymount, Robin Wong, who works a lot on Taoist philosophy and taught a class on it during my second year there. It wasn't, Asian philosophies weren't well integrated throughout my undergrad. I don't think there was a single class offered on it. It's so long ago at this point. And it certainly wasn't regularly taught in any of my graduate programs, really, other than LMU. And even thinking beyond that, I don't think there's been a single course offered in African philosophy at any of the programs I've been at. There have been some courses in Latin American philosophy here at Emory in the last few years. Mm-hmm. So Robin Wong, the woman I mentioned earlier, used to put it in this way that I really found really transformative in how I think about doing philosophy, which is that if you're not studying philosophy in this sort of broad, pluralistic sense, if you're only reading Eurocentric thinkers, then what you're actually doing isn't really so much philosophy as it is like an area studies.
Men's studies,
but also, right, Eurocentric women, people like Arendt and Beauvoir,
right,
or God, Gustave and Irigaray. Yeah, so it hasn't been super well integrated. I mean, I remember when I went to Memphis, I mentioned that I really planned to continue working with Chinese philosophy, with Japanese philosophy, and being told by the grad director at the time that we don't do that here. And so if I wanted to do that, I should probably think about going elsewhere. And that just being such a strange thing to be told, we don't do that here. Like, I would get in trouble for doing it.
Yeah, that's sometimes, I think, an argument that some institutions use to almost defend their lack of diversity in their syllabi. Like, you know, we do that really well. You know, we do, as you mentioned before, Heidegger, we do Heidegger really well, we do Kant really well, and we just don't do the other stuff. But as you said, that's a bit weird.
Yeah, it's strange to me that it's a question of whether or not we should also be reading thinkers like Zhuangzi as much as we're reading people like Kant. In part because I think it impoverishes our understanding of the world, and a philosophy is in part supposed to be about that. And for me, one of the things that studying Chinese and Japanese philosophy in particular was what's so frustrating about it is seeing all of the ways in which you can see European thinkers in conversation with these figures.
Yeah.
Sometimes deliberately, right? In the case of like someone like Schopenhauer, but also oftentimes implicitly. Like, there's a lot that could be done, and that is getting done by some people, with noticing these areas of conversation where there's a lot of mutually informative work happening.
So, Tamsin, we talked about whiteness both as a here and as a there in the context of talking about this idea of orientation. One thing that you talk about in your paper is then the concept of disorientation, which, these are my words and not yours, you present almost, correct me if I'm wrong, as a revolutionary technique. So I wanted to ask you if you could explain what you mean by disorientation and why you argue that Asian Americans might be particularly well placed to try and reorganize the structure and norms of her life through disorientation.
Yeah. So in part, I was thinking, when I think about disorientation, what it means to be disoriented, right? If whiteness is the orientation, right? If living in the United States means that one is oriented around and toward whiteness, mm-hmm. becoming disoriented means stepping away from those kinds of guideposts, those kinds of markers of success, unlearning those kinds of habits and norms that we have no choice but to inherit. Revolution, I don't know that I would call it revolutionary necessarily. In part, I think about it in terms of, yeah, it's similar, I think, to what Audre Lorde talks about when she's talking about the work of building coalition, right? And thinking across lines of race, lines of class, sexuality, gender, age, that we've inherited certain norms of interpretation, norms of action, norms of behavior. And part of the work of becoming disoriented is letting go of those and not necessarily knowing what's going to replace them. And I think that's the more difficult part. Oftentimes the question is, well, what are we going to do if we don't have this particular norm? Like, if we're not worried about professionalism in the discipline, then what are we going to do? And the answer oftentimes for me is, well, I don't really know, but I know that what we have right now doesn't work for so many of us. And I would rather take the risk of stepping away from what is known, what isn't working, and try out these different and alternative modes of engagement.
I think that what you said earlier about how you defined philosophy, that's really how I take philosophy, is as a method and not so much about what the content is. And I think sometimes people get really focused on, well, if you're doing philosophy, it means you have to be engaging with these particular people, these particular thinkers, these particular ways of thinking about being. But
yeah,
like you said, that if it is really about just deeply questioning all of our assumptions and trying to widen our view of being, then incorporating other types of thinkers is really central to that.
Yeah, I mean, like, writing the chapter that we're talking about was in some ways a disorienting experience, because I was very intentional about not citing any white men, which, as someone trained in philosophy, turns out to be very hard to do. To have to consciously think, no, I don't need, I mean, I'm talking about orientation in the text and I'm hovering around phenomenology a lot, but to say that I just have the deliberate conversation with myself that I don't need to talk about Merleau-Ponty, that I don't need to talk about Husserl mm-hmm. in this particular context, right, was a kind of disorienting experience, but it allowed different kinds of connections, I think, to emerge, right? And obviously Sarah Ahmed is talking about those kinds of thinkers, so I'm not that far removed from them, but it was a particular kind of challenge. And I think you're exactly right, Kay, that it clarified for me that philosophy really is about a way of engaging a problem, a text, more than it is about the content of what it is that we're doing.
Right. And like you have said, that you have a lot of interest in particular political implications of ideas and the political environment. I think sometimes people can get a little up in arms about philosophy being so relatable or actually talking about what's going on. But in regards to that, I was curious if you talk in this paper about this need for an awareness of how our views are shaped by white heteropatriarchy. And it sounds like in the process of writing this paper, there was an awareness that it granted you. Do you feel like right now there is a moment where there's consciousness raising specifically in regards to how we're shaped by white heteropatriarchy? And I mean, in particular, with the recent rise in support of like the Black Lives Matter movement, etc. And I was also curious, because in this paper you discuss how American racial politics sometimes pits Asian Americans against Black Americans. And I just was curious how you see that relating to the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're living in a very particular kind of moment with this. I think there is more conversation happening now about, like, ordinary people having conversations about white supremacy. that I couldn't have imagined happening a couple of years ago, even. At the same time, I think that it looks like there are areas in which, or ways in which we're falling back into certain traps, right? Certain ways of thinking. For example, like the recent effort to defund the police, right, has spawned huge conversations about the racist history of policing in the United States, mm-hmm. ways in which policing is inextricable from anti-Black racism. But at the same time, there's a lot of attempts to sort of pull back, to soften the demands to defund the police, to abolish the police, and to take a reformist approach that we know, at the end of the day, sort of benefits a white supremacist politics. So I think it is a moment in which there is movement and there's possibility, but there's also the chance of just sort of falling back into sort of set patterns. And in terms of like how this works in terms of comparative racialization, right, that process by which racial minority groups get pitted against one another mm-hmm. in the U.S. sort of racial landscape. It is absolutely the case, right, that as Asian Americans, especially those of us who are East Asian or South Asian, we've had sort of enormous racial privilege when compared to Black and Indigenous folks in particular, and that we've sort of fed into that in a lot of ways, right? Adopting anti-Black attitudes and behaviors. One of the things that's been really encouraging about the last few months, though, is seeing how particularly younger Asian Americans, so millennials and Gen Zers, are sort of stepping up to have real conversations about these kinds of topics. There's a group, I think they're based out of New York, the Asian American Feminist Collective, that's been doing a lot of work around Asian and Black solidarity in the present moment and also going forward, right? There's a Facebook group called Subtle Asian Traits that has, I don't even know how many hundreds of thousands of people in it. And there have been posts there about these kinds of topics where people are having sort of sustained engagements with anti-Black racism in Asian communities and Asian American communities and Asian communities around the world. So I think there is a sense, at least generationally among Asian Americans, that this is a kind of responsibility that we have to be in solidarity with Black and Latinx and Indigenous folks instead of with white people who have traditionally been the demographic that we've turned to for political alliance. Mm. But it is, I think, largely generational.
Do you think that the coronavirus in particular has affected, I mean, I think it's kind of obvious that it has, but maybe how has it affected sentiment towards Asian Americans or, yeah, I guess the political situation with Asian Americans in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, the incredible rise in xenophobic, racist actions against Asian Americans, especially Chinese Americans across the country, I think was definitely a galvanizing force. I mean, it was already the case that Asian Americans were experiencing a surge in hate crimes perpetrated against them even before the coronavirus. But certainly, I think the awareness of how precarious that sort of racial privilege is, I think has come through a lot in the present moment, as we see how quickly the virus gets labeled a Chinese virus or Kung flu, and how quickly people who might have otherwise fetishized Asian Americans have turned on us, I think was certainly transformative for a number of people.
One interesting thing, Tamsin, that you say about Asian Americans and the perception of Asian Americans in the U.S. when you compare them to other communities is that, unlike, for example, Arab Americans or Latin Americans, the Asian American community in the United States is not characterized, you say, by one event or one rhetoric or narrative. Could you explain to our listeners what you mean by that?
Yeah. So part of what I'm thinking about, right, some of this is coming out of response to Andrea Smith's Three Pillars of White Heteropatriarchy. And she sort of lumps Latin Americans, Asian Americans, and Arab Americans into one pillar that's sort of characterized by a link to perpetual foreignness. And I think there is something to that potentially. But one thing that I've noticed is that it's difficult to think of a particular rhetoric other than the sort of model minority myth that tries to capture all of Asian America in the way that, for example, the language around terrorism has affected Arab American communities, and the way in which Muslim identity has been racialized, and the way in which conversations around immigration have sort of in many ways organized Latinx politics in the United States. I haven't seen as much coalescing around a particular problem or conversation, in part because, Latin American, Arab American, these are all collective identity terms, but Asian American is too, right? And it is one that we adopted self-consciously at one point and then has just sort of become broadly applied without really carefully thinking about the politics. But there's a huge diversity of Asian American experiences. Oftentimes when we talk about Asian Americans, we're only talking about East Asians, people from China, Japan, Korea. Yeah. And we have no awareness of any of the other varieties of Asian American experiences. And so that it becomes sort of easy to assume that all of us equally have access to these kinds of racial privilege. But it's simply not true when we look at the numbers broken down along these different ethnic lines. And when we look at the nature of, I think, conflict between different Asian ethnic groups. I mean, so my family is Japanese and Korean. And one of the things that's always funny to me is that people who are familiar with the histories of Japan and South Korea are always surprised that that's the mixture because of the kinds of historical and present tensions there are. But that's not a conversation that I think most people in the US are aware of, because we have this very flat picture of Asian Americans that's apolitical, that's ahistorical, that seems to center around nothing in particular.
Earlier we mentioned the recent coronavirus pandemic, and one philosopher that you deal with in your work is Foucault. One thing you elaborate on is his concept of race when you talk about the will to race, understood as the drive to master and perfect the race, which is normally led by the state. And you quote in one of your works, Erlen Bush Anderson's description of racism as a principle of exclusion and segregation deployed to protect the health of the population from abnormal elements internal to the social body. So something that I've been thinking of lately is what this new COVID and hopefully soon enough post-COVID world will look like as states introduce new biopolitical measures, which I presume will not just be COVID-related, but that will constitute maybe a broader shift in the way some things are done in the wake of this pandemic. So when I think of this word to come, I worry that it will be a word with a strong will to race, in the sense that it could be a very exclusionary word, since not everyone will be affected in the same way by these new measures and ways of doing things. What do you think we've got coming our way?
Yeah, I mean, in part, I don't know that it's going to be a whole new world for many people. I think the pandemic has laid bare a lot of what was already there in terms of the racialized health inequities that we have in this country, in the United States. Mm-hmm. A lot of my research, for example, focuses on indigenous populations and the racialization of health outcomes there. And the pandemic has been devastating to indigenous communities. It's difficult to get nationwide data because of how few indigenous people there are in many states. They don't warrant oftentimes tracking. But in the places where we do have data, the rates of death and infection are significantly higher among indigenous communities, especially in reservation spaces, right? And a lot of that has to do with histories of settler colonialism, right? That were already there, that have already been building and put in place. This disaster was already happening. This moment has accelerated it. Whatever the world looks like after this isn't going to be something radically new. It's going to be continuous with them, right? So there's been some stuff coming out recently, in particular about the Navajo Nation, which is something that I have talked about in some of my work. one of the things that gets mentioned oftentimes is that there are a lot of people who are living on the Navajo Nation and the reservation who don't have access to running water. And it's treated as though that's just like a choice that Indigenous people, that Navajo people have made. In some cases, it might be, but part of what's also at stake are whole histories of extraction around uranium in that region of the country, right? The Four Corners area, the Navajo Nation, that have made the water unpotable, that have irradiated it to such a point that it can't actually be used. So access to water wasn't just something that happened that then the pandemic made an issue. It was already an issue for health and wellness. And the pandemic just accelerated what was already in many cases happening. So yeah, when we're talking about biopolitical, right, I also want to keep in mind what Mbembe calls the necropolitical, right? The mastery and perfection of the race, the normal population of the race, of the state, as Foucault might put it, also depends on the outright elimination, the sort of permanent war on communities that are deemed abnormal or not worth preserving, right? And it's looking at the numbers from the pandemic coming out of Indigenous communities, it's hard for me to see that as anything but a continuation of this ongoing violence of settler colonialism. So post-COVID, I don't know that it's going to be, the conditions for people of color in this country are going to be significantly worse. Other than that, we will have borne the brunt of the virus. But the measures that are implemented are already the measures that are in place.
Right. I think it is very obvious that this just exacerbated conditions that were already in existence, as you said, that people who didn't have good healthcare access for their whole lives are going to be more at risk for dying. And as you said about clean water and housing and all of these other issues that we already have as a nation, they're just exacerbated. What I was curious about in terms of your discussion of Foucault and like hygienic practices, what first came up for me was in terms of gender and thinking about hygienic beauty practices, in the sense of what we do almost unconsciously or subconsciously in order to maintain a certain gendered expression or, you know, being registered in a certain way, if that makes sense. And I was curious what you think in terms of, I guess, how to break down those unconscious or subconscious routines, or how to like sort of queer up our hygienic gender practices, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, in part, when I'm thinking about hygiene in relation to gender, I'm thinking about it less in terms of beauty practices, although that would be an interesting way to take it, and more in terms of the purification of a category. Mm-hmm. So I think we have lots of conversations now in philosophy where a lot of people have very strong opinions about what it means for someone to be a woman, for example.
Yes.
They seem to have very clear definitions. Didn't have them before, they have them now. And they're usually pretty bad.
Agreed, yeah.
But they have the weight of political force behind them. And that, to me, is the sort of kind of hygiene that I'm interested in talking about, right? These attempts to sterilize, to purify a category of gender, right?
Yeah.
Such that you have, you know, TERFs, trans-exclusionary radical feminists, on record saying essentially that women of color aren't really women in the same way that white women are, and don't necessarily count as much, right? In the attempt to exclude trans women from the category, they've managed to exclude a great number of people from the category.
So do you have a definition of woman? I know that's also similar to me asking about your definition of philosophy, but I'm just curious how it operates in terms of thinking about the mind-body dualism that's often present in a lot of discussion of trans theory, where there's this idea that the body is one thing and then the mind is this separate thing. I mean, I'm just curious how you position yourself in that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I have a good definition of woman. There was a time in my academic career where I really wanted to have one, and I really wanted to come up with a good definition, a good metaphysical account. But at the end of the day, right, these are, like, the best I've been able to figure is that our gender concepts are usually cluster concepts. That oftentimes when we're talking about men and women, we're not talking about a singular thing. Instead, we're talking about a whole variety of things that get sort of clustered together. That's sort of the best that I've got, approximation that I've got. And as far as, like, the mind-body stuff, I mean, some of that I think depends on one's particular orientation to doing trans work, to doing trans philosophical work or trans studies work. I mean, for me, one of the things that, like, transitioning changed a lot in terms of how I approach not just the world, but in terms of doing the kind of work that I do. Like, it's incredibly funny to me that I am sort of most associated with phenomenology as someone who for a long time did not like phenomenology and didn't really think that it had anything to offer in terms of philosophical analysis. The experience of transitioning, right, and having all of these new experiences mm-hmm. is part of what made phenomenology re-register for me in a different way, right? And I think that those are the kinds of accounts of trans phenomena that I'm most interested in that sort of integrate the sort of broad conceptual work with lived experience. I think that's where the sort of richest work happens in trans philosophical work, where there's a sort of integration of these kinds of things happening in a way that hopefully avoids concerns about mind-body dualism. Although I have to admit, I haven't thought about that as the sort of particular concern in relation to transition.
One other thing that you talk about in your work is the so-called transgender tipping point, understood as a raise in public awareness of some trans women, especially some public figures. You mentioned, for example, Caitlyn Jenner. And one thing that I was wondering is, so Caitlyn Jenner, for example, said stuff like, I think she said that she always, all along, had a female brain. I was wondering if you, because I don't think I'm in the position to say what is a good way to talk about the experience of being a transgender person, but maybe you could. And I was wondering if you would be, you know, if you would say that there are better and worse ways of talking about it, especially for, you know, what these things that are said imply for, you know, about how gender is understood.
Yeah, I mean, so basically there are problems with the wrong body model, which is sort of the one that Caitlyn Jenner employs, right? So she's always known that she was a woman, she was just born in the wrong body, or she's always had a female brain and the rest of her body didn't match up, right? And that part of the process of transitioning is getting into the right body. There are obviously problems with that kind of a narrative. I mean, the biggest one, right, is that that's not how all of us experience our gender and are coming to terms with it. I don't know that I would say that I always knew that I had this other thing going on. I mean, I can say that I was always uncomfortable with being put into, like, boy or man categories, but I don't know that that means that I necessarily had this more positive picture of what I thought was going on. At the same time, though, there are people who experience themselves that way, who experience their gender that way. And so you also don't want to say that that's impossible, right? For some mm-hmm. people, that may be exactly how they came into their identity or how they understood their gender all along. So in my mind, I don't know that I would want to come down on the side of, like, there's a particularly right way to talk about trans identity. I think there are better and worse ways, for sure. I think ways that reinforce the idea that the state has or should have any role in adjudicating gender and administrating gender, as Dean Spade puts it. Mm-hmm. I think those are problematic discourses that we should do away with. I think the idea that we become gender when we have medical interventions, mm-hmm. right, is incredibly problematic too. Not just because there are people who don't want those kinds of interventions, but there are also many, many people who can't afford them. They're very expensive. It is very expensive to transition in this country, which is why it's so funny to me that people think we do it for fun.
I know.
Yeah, it's incredibly expensive. And so it's out of reach for many people, given the nature of healthcare in this country. So as far as better and worse ways go, I think for cis researchers who are interested in talking about or thinking about trans experience, the most important thing that you can do is actually read the work of trans people, right? And yeah. recognize that we're not going to agree with one another. So I'm part of a group of trans philosophers, and we're regularly on panels together, and we are in conversation all the time. We organize things. We don't all agree with one another. If you read all of our work, you have different pictures of what gender, what trans sort of looks like. If you read memoir and fiction by trans people, if you consume trans media, you end up with conflicting pictures of what trans identity looks like. And I think for cis researchers who are interested in thinking about these kinds of topics, learning to be okay with those contradictions is, I think, an important step. And in recognizing perhaps that it's not for you to pass judgment on which ones are right or wrong.
On that note, or somewhat on that note, because we've already discussed a little bit about how to define womanhood and such, I wasn't sure if you have engaged with Andrea Long Chu or the work Females that she wrote last year. But in that work, she, first of all, takes the term female, which often, of course not always, but often has been used to talk about the body rather than woman, which has often been used to talk about the social category. And she basically says, well, everyone's female, and takes sort of a definition that's like psychical about, you know, having a certain selflessness, etc. But in this work, she also does talk about Caitlyn Jenner and Gigi Gorgeous and other trans figures that in this discussion of authenticity often set the beauty standards for cis women, which is one of her points, that in this idea of like what makes an authentic woman or what makes an authentic man or whatever, that like these ideas are really blurry and nebulous. And in fact, the way that like cis women set their standards or like strive to look like Gigi Gorgeous or Caitlyn Jenner sort of blurs this idea that there is a body that is going to express a certain gender better or whatever. So yeah, I was just curious if you read that or what you think about that sort of discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be honest. I never quite know what to do with Andrea's work, Andrea Long Chu's work. I mean, even the females thing, it's characterized as a bit, and I never quite know how seriously to take what she says. I think that's intentional in some ways. So I don't know, but I mean, I can certainly talk about how strict beauty standards, strict ideas of what it is to look like or a man or a woman impact trans people's lives. Mm-hmm. Like, absolutely, that is a conversation that we have amongst ourselves, right? Like, the discourse of passing is very common. You know, how to avoid getting sort of clocked as a trans person, how to just sort of get through the day without dealing with that. Is like, it is a conversation, and it is one that I think is important for a lot of people. And it's a difficult one, because I don't know that there is a right answer there either. I think, like, with a lot of things in transitioning and trans studies, right? So one of the things that I think we have to keep in mind when we're doing academic work in trans studies is that we're also talking about things that people have to live, systems that people have to navigate. I think sometimes we lose sight of that. It's easy to lose sight of that when we're having just these academic discussions. But for some people, right, passing can often mean whether or not they get to and from work without harassment, whether or not they can go shopping for groceries without being stopped or stared at. Yeah, so for me, this is part of, I think, just my general ethos with how I do the work. Like, these are real things that people have to live with. And I think the best kind of work is the kind that's attentive to that, that there is a kind of risk for people in passing, in talking about passing. And even as academics, it's not something that we get away from entirely. We still have to deal with it in a variety of ways. Right. Like, I mean, I was on the job market this past year, and I had to have conversations with people about a whole bunch of gendered norms for what being professional or looking professional sort of looked like, what it meant to sort of pass as a professional femme person in that kind of a context.
In regards to that, you discussed earlier, and this is maybe a complex question, but it involves passing, both in terms of race and in terms of gender, because you had talked before about just how you're read, right? So it seems like both of these concepts, a lot of how we're going to be treated is about how others read us, not necessarily how we identify ourselves, if that makes sense. And I'm curious, you talked also about like epistemic distortion that occurs in terms of like essentializing different people, but also living under the white hetero patriarchy, etc. So I'm curious what you think, what substantive actions that we as students or just as people can take to try to sort of remedy those sorts of distortions in ourselves when looking at others, or even potentially when others look at us. I know that's like a very complex question, but.
Yeah, I mean, in part, right, I think that's it's an impossible task to completely eliminate these kinds of distortions in terms of how we encounter, understand others, and even how we encounter and understand ourselves, right? Like how others read us is a huge concern, but also how we read ourselves is also really important. I mean, one of the common things that you hear trans people talk about is not really realizing that we're trans until we sort of encounter that concept or that set of concepts out in the world in some way, and it giving a language to experience, right? So yeah, it's tricky. I mean, part of the way that I think we do it is by actually bothering to read more broadly than I think we're told. So thinking in particular about philosophy, right? As philosophers want to study more and more questions about race and gender and sexuality, I think one of the things that has to be overcome is the idea that philosophy is all we need to do this kind of work. Like, I read too many articles on race, on gender, where the only texts people are engaging are things by other people with PhDs in philosophy or by people in the Western philosophical canon. People who have no idea, for example, why we shouldn't try to make analogous arguments about race and gender, why it is that we have to talk about different particular histories that are at stake when we're talking about the history of race or the history of gender. And these are also the kinds of questions that I sometimes get at philosophy conferences, right? Where to them, it seems sort of arbitrary that I might draw a line between that. But if you've read extensively in work on race or gender or sexuality, outside of philosophy, these are sort of settled debates in many ways. And I think sometimes in philosophy, we have the problem of thinking that debates are only settled or can only be settled, or these conversations only matter when we have them. Mm. I think there's a kind of arrogance to how we're trained to do this kind of work, and not trained, right? In many cases, right, a lot of us who do work on race and gender weren't trained to do it because it wasn't seen as properly philosophical. So sometimes we're just stumbling. One of the things that I think has been most helpful for me is going outside of philosophy, spending a lot of time outside of philosophy, and not just in the academy too, right? I think there's also the danger of sort of armchair work. If you're doing work on race, gender, things like that, if you're concerned with questions of inequality, of injustice, I think you have a responsibility to actually be doing engaged work in the streets, doing actual activist work, recognizing that your scholarship isn't sufficient, that reading alone isn't sufficient for understanding these kinds of topics, seeing them as live rather than as puzzles. I think we are really attached to puzzles in philosophy. We really like to solve problems and to point out conundrums and things like that. But I don't know. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Oh, no, I appreciate your answer.
I was just going to say, yeah, for me, my work has been significantly better the more I've done outside of philosophy.
We're talking about reading and books. So I just was wondering if there was some recent piece of writing that has inspired you in particular, or if there's something that has come out recently and that you're excited to read. And just more in general, who are some figures in trans theory that you think we should be reading?
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, there's let me start with the last one and then work my way backwards.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really exciting stuff happening in trans philosophy and trans studies right now. I would be very remiss if I didn't mention the work of dear friends of mine, Andrea Pitts, who's doing really fascinating work. Right now, they're working on questions about the medical-industrial complex and relationships between trans theory, disability studies, and critiques of coloniality. Really fascinating work that's happening that I'm so excited about. Perry Zern has been doing fantastic work on curiosity, and I think his book must be coming out soon. I think he's just finished a draft of it. So hopefully within the next year, it'll be out. Talia Betcher's book is nearing completion, I think, and I'm excited for that to be in the world. Amy Marvin has done really exceptional work in trans theory and philosophy that I turn to a lot when I'm thinking about questions of sexual objectification, which is a topic that I write about a bit. Yeah, she has, yeah, it's just that I'm hoping she publishes this paper on chasers that is just fantastic. And then more broadly, Pedro Di Pietro has been doing really good, fascinating work on the coloniality of gender and pushing trans studies to engage with these questions more and thinking about gender variance in sort of Latin American contexts that I think is really interesting to read. Riley Snorton has been continuing to do really great work around the intersections of trans and Black studies. And there are more and more people popping up, it seems, in the last few years, mm-hmm. which is really sort of encouraging to see. So I think right now trans studies is in a very exciting moment. There's new stuff coming out all the time. So I don't know if you can go wrong, really, as long as you're reading broadly.
That's great.
I think is the key. And then, yeah, in terms of things that have come out recently that are really exciting to me, Liat Ben-Moshe just published a book. It's called Decarcerating Disability that's currently sitting on my desk that I'm looking forward to reading and teaching in a class this fall. Miley Arvin's book, Possessing Polynesians, I think is the name of it, came out recently, and it's a really great engagement with questions of science studies in a Polynesian context that I think has really interesting material for thinking about Indigenous studies sort of more broadly. Yeah, those are two of the texts that sort of jumped to mind in terms of things that I'm really excited about or that I've really enjoyed.
Okay, that's great. A lot to read. So was there a trans writer that you read that was like maybe your first encounter or something that you really connected with?
Yeah, it's Talia Betcher.
Okay.
She was the first sort of trans person that I read right as I was sort of coming to terms with my own gender mm-hmm. identity and realizing that I wanted to do the kind of work that I do now. Mm-hmm. A lot of what she said just sort of captured experiences that I was having as I was having them. Yeah, I love her work.
Is there a good place to start? Like, is there one paper or something that you would say is a good place to start with, Talia?
Oh, I mean, Evil Deceivers and Make Believers is one that I think people often start with.
Okay.
I think the first thing I actually read by her, though, was I think it was When Selves Have Sex, which, yeah, I think it's an article that continues to fascinate me and that I think about a lot as I write about phenomenologies of transsexuality.
As we move towards the end of this interview, which has been very exciting, and I really enjoyed talking with you. We always try to end with some lighter questions, and one thing that we always ask our guests is, if you hadn't become a philosopher, what would you have liked to become? What would you have liked to study, or what job you would have liked to get? Anything of that kind.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I have become a philosopher yet. But I think about this a lot. If I were to have started all over again, I think I would be a baker.
Oh, wow. I didn't expect that.
I love baking and figuring out how it works. So I like the idea of doing something with my hands that produces something that more people will enjoy.
Yeah, I guess there are ways that philosophy is kind of like baking.
Oh, I don't know if that makes me want to do it more or less.
Well, you have to be precise, I suppose, with baking as well, right? The measurement would be very precise. I'm not sure.
it was interesting, like, preparing for this interview, going back and reading things and just being like, oh, God, why do I write that way? Why do I say the things that I say?
Oh, what? Well, we were thinking, you know, kind of the opposite. That, wow, really great the way that you said this. So I wouldn't worry about that. Could you tell us, like, maybe just in 1 minute, is there anything special, like, outside of philosophy that you're working on? Any projects or anything?
Yeah, I mean, I'm part of a group of organizers, community organizers here in the Atlanta area where I currently live. Mm-hmm. And we've been organizing a series of community workshops and teach-ins and discussions about police and prison abolition. And I'm excited for the kinds of projects that we have sort of lined up and the kinds of campaigns that we're hoping to be doing in the future.
Wow, that sounds really cool. So that is a lot of that stuff outside community teach-ins, that kind of thing? Or I know that right now it might be really difficult to meet in person.
Yeah, we've tried to hold socially distanced events outdoors. A number of our people who work with us are in community health, public health kind of settings. And so they've been able to advise us on best practices and things like that. And we've been really working to expand accessibility. So we've been trying to figure out ways, because a lot of times activist spaces aren't very accessible for disabled people. And this is a conversation, an ongoing conversation we've been having about how to improve accessibility, how to sort of foreground accessibility when we're planning events and things like that.
So I think on that note, first of all, thank you so much to Tamsin Kimoto for joining us today, for being such a good thinker. And I think also for being really good at this. I really enjoyed this interview. And I hope Kay and Tamsin and the people that we listen to this will enjoy it as much as we did, I think.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I really enjoyed reading your work. I just wanted to reiterate that.